Good evening, and thank you very much for inviting me to wrap up the Book of Esther, or as I'm going to rename it shortly, the Book of Ahasuerus, with Chapter 10. Every time I'm here, I feel like I should be here more often, but it's the way it is. I'm here when I can be. Rabbi Kanofsky is always very gracious in inviting me. I want to congratulate all of you for making it all the way to the 10th parak, the 10th chapter, which, if you're using the brown art scrolls, is on page 50. And it looks like such an innocent, quiet chapter, right? No one's banging anymore. We're all done with that. The threats are over. Haman is gone. Esther is the queen. Mordechai is the viceroy. And we ride into the sunset. But looking more closely at the chapter added a new layer to my understanding of the Megillah as a whole, beginning to end. And that's why when Rabbi Kanofsky asked me if I would teach a class, and he said, which chapter would you like? That's why I picked number 10. It wasn't to give myself more time to do this. And it wasn't because it's short, because you have to remember the rule, right? The shorter it is, the harder it is to find something new to say. When you have a long chapter, there's always something you can say. What do you do with a short chapter? But I have something that was new for me, a new way to look at the Book of Esther for me, and I hope that that it will be meaningful for you as well. Let's read through the chapter since it's so brief. Three sentences. I think we can do it. And again, at the bottom of page 50, page 51, King Ahasuerus placed Mas, a tax, on the land and on the islands of the sea. I read the Megillah every year. It was actually with my bar mitzvah parsha, so I've done it every year since. And I love reading the Megillah. And some of the things that you do when you read the Megillah, as opposed to listening to it, you pick up on certain things that aren't necessarily obvious to everybody. So every year, pretty much, on one of my Megillah readings, when I get to the beginning of the 10th chapter, I start laying it, Vayasem Hamelach Ahasuerus Mas, and then I pause. King Ahasuerus levied taxes, and I'm always waiting for somebody to boo at that point. And it doesn't happen, because I think it's only if you're reading it that you're thinking about that. Otherwise, you're thinking about, oh, this is almost over. But yes, you can pause there, and everybody can boo at the taxes. But he places a tax on the land and on the islands of the sea. And all his might, all his power, ufarashat gedulat Mordechai, and the full account, as they translate it here, of the greatness of Mordechai, who was elevated by the king, it's all recorded in the chronicles of the kings of Media and Persia. And the last sentence, which of course people traditionally read aloud ahead of the reader, for Mordechai the Jew, Mordechai the Yehudi, was the viceroy for King Ahasuerus. He was great for the Jews. He was beloved to the multitude of his brethren. I'm going to come back to that one. He sought good for his people, and he spoke peace, or he sought the welfare of all of his descendants. My siblings always like to know, since my first name is Mordechai, that the passage that we just read that describes Mordechai being beloved or popular here with the multitude of his brethren, do we have Hebrew readers here? Some? Okay. Tell me something. How else could you read that clause in the Hebrew? Virotsui lerov echav.
Wanted by,
okay.
As opposed to popular, that's
okay.
Watched him as being the head of the people.
Bingo, bingo. Rove, sorry.
Or to most,
right? Rove does not have to mean multitude. It can, but frequently rove is majority. He was beloved to most of his brethren. This is what you call faint praise, right? Or worse. Here we are at the end of the book. We've talked about all the wonderful things that Mordechai and Esther did for the Jews. And our encomium, this final word of praise for Mordechai. He is the viceroy for Ahasuerus. He is great for the Jews. And most of his brethren liked him. So take a look at source number one, which is a medrash on that. This isn't the point of the class, but I couldn't talk about that sentence without highlighting this. Rashi has a variation of this. Ibn Ezra has a sharp variation of this. But I brought you the midrash, which is older than the comments of both of them. This teaches, I apologize for only including the English on the sources, but the I wanted to fit it all on just, you know, front and back. Mercy on the office at KST. But this teaches that one cannot satisfy everyone. No one was as good for Israel as Mordechai. And yet it says of him that he was beloved for rove of his brothers, not for all of them. You can't win them all. That's just the way it goes. And actually, Midrashim talk about how specifically the sages may have been disappointed in Mordechai because he got involved in politics, and that's somewhat unseemly for someone who had been a scholar and a leader in the realm of religion. So, you know, he's kind of come down by getting messed up in politics. Fine, either way, those are your three sentences. That's your whole chapter. Yeah. Ah, so maybe it's because he's associated with the taxes. In that case, though, it probably would have said he was beloved by none of his brethren. If Mordechai is going to get blamed for the taxes, then who's going to like him? But here's my question. In this chapter, who is the protagonist? Who is the hero? Or not even the hero, but who's the main figure? Yeah. Who would you say? Ahasuerus? I heard an Esther, although I'm not sure why. Well, sorry? Correct. But where does she show up in this chapter? Doesn't at all. Yes?
I would have thought Mordechai, actually, because of the showing how great he was to the Jews, that he was wanted by the Jews. And frankly, if I had to pay taxes, I don't object to taxes. I thank God if I have the money to pay taxes. And that, you know, you want to give to community, and I would rather give to a Jew than, you know, who's representing me, than to a foreign, an alien person. You know, Ahasuerus is more alien. So.
Oh, I wouldn't assume that Mordechai had any freedom as to what was happening with the tax dollars.
Not freedom, but still feeling that it might be treated, that he might look into how the money was used, for instance.
Okay.
And it says also, Derish Homamo, he's seeking good for his people. So these are, you know, he's being looked up to as, in some sense, as a hero, as representative for them, and making sure that there was... that he was looking for good and peace.
Right. So I think you can make the case. Yes. You can definitely make the case that Mordechai is the hero in this chapter. You can make that case. But I would make the case that Ahasuerus is actually the central figure in this chapter. In sentence one, we find out he issued a tax. In sentence two, we find out he is great and mighty, and he is responsible for the power that Mordechai has. Gidlow, he is the one who raised, elevated Mordechai. And then in sentence three, sure, Mordechai is great, but he is the viceroy to Ahasuerus. Fundamentally, he serves the needs of Ahasuerus. Now, you have to always be careful when you mind read a chapter in Judaism, when you try to say, this chapter is about this. And the reason why you have to be careful is because, and someone may have said this in one of the previous nine classes, but the chapter breaks are not ours. Right? The Christians are the ones who invented the chapter breaks. So strictly speaking, it's not as though you can read into the Megillah and say the Megillah is trying to isolate this chapter. Nonetheless, there is a paragraph break at the start of the chapter, and this paragraph, to me, is really about Ahasuerus. We are concluding the book with a description of the power of Ahasuerus. He issued a tax. He's the one who elevated Mordechai and made everything Mordechai did possible. He was great and mighty. And so my question to you is, why would you end the book of Esther with a description of the power of Ahasuerus? Yeah?
Well, in some sense, when you're highlighting Ahasuerus, it's showing that the power is key Mordechai. He is doing these things because of the work of Mordechai. that we always have a hand working with God to influence on our behalf, and that we should partner in that way, and we should be watchful.
So you're saying we're highlighting Achashverosh, but really as a means of showing that it's...
That you can influence. He could have gone either way, Achashverosh.
He did go either way.
Exactly. And so the input of a Jewish person representing the people had an influence. And, and so it says, it says, Yesam Achashverosh, etc. And it says, he Mordechai, because Mordechai did these things.
Good. So I'm going to come back to that idea, because we'll see Ibn Ezra tap into exactly that. More, though. You could look at it and say that we want to end with a high note for Achashverosh to get into his good graces. Right? Remember, this book is going to be read in Persia. You're in good shape if you end the book with "the king is great." That's generally a good way to get into the top 10 list. And otherwise, if you don't end that way, you could end up in the other top 10 list that appeared in chapter 9, right? The ones with the tree. So it could be that it's simply a pragmatic statement. Let's have something at the end. Here's a word for our sponsor. That's possible. But I think there's another element here, and I think it's a message that's about Achashverosh and therefore about us as well. I want to go back to the tax in sentence 1. The tax is interesting. Because if I wanted to describe the power of King Achashverosh, I could have just said, Achashverosh was great and mighty. But I chose to highlight it by mentioning specifically that he ordered a tax upon the nations. It's actually very interesting. This isn't something that I'm going to focus on in the class, but something that just occurred to me as I was reading through the chapter is that Achashverosh starts the book as a spender, holding big parties for everybody. Everybody can come in and enjoy my largesse. And then at the end, he's a taker. He's taking money. Now, you could argue there's a new cycle that's starting, and had there been a sequel to Esther, it would have started with a new party funded by the tax that appeared at the end of this one. You can make that argument. But Ibn Ezra comments on, Rabbi Avraham Ibn Ezra comments on this line about the tax, and he fits it into the context in chapter 10, highlighting what Esther just pointed out, which is the association with Mordechai. If you take a look at source number 2, Rabbi Avraham Ibn Ezra says, writing in the end of the 11th century, beginning of the 12th, he says, the text mentioned the tax, to teach that he, Achashverosh, succeeded in all of his ways, and his might was visible, because Mordechai was his viceroy. So it's telling me Achashverosh was able to make a tax because Mordechai was working for him. That's why he was able to do this. And that's one way to look at it. The Maharal of Prague took it in the opposite direction. Also looked at it based on context. But he says, no. The fuel for the tax is chapter 9. When Achashverosh, through the Jews, ends up executing Haman and executing Haman's family. So you take a look at source number 3. Because of the great deed, that's actually a bad translation that I did. I was rushing too much when I did that. Because of the great deed, he performed to Haman, not Haman performed. That's my mistake in writing too quickly. See, when you do a spell check, you need a content check also. Because of the great deed he, Achashverosh, performed to Haman, meaning executing Haman, Achashverosh's throne was feared. So everyone listened to him, even though he placed taxes upon them. In other words, also driven by context. You saw Achashverosh punish Haman, and therefore, when the tax bill came in the mail, you said, would you like me to add anything to that? That's the way that the Maharal of Prague looks at it. Two practical explanations for what we are doing here by mentioning the tax. Either we're highlighting Mordechai's good service of Achashverosh, or we are highlighting the fear that people have because of what happened to Haman. However, the Maharal of Prague referenced this tax in another one of his writings. He wrote a commentary to the Book of Esther called Or Chadash, A New Light. But he also has a separate work in which, in source number 4, he gives us a different perspective on what the text tells us about Achashverosh And that's what's going to fascinate me in the course of our discussion, is what the text tells us, what the text tells us about Ahasuerus. He begins in source number 4 by quoting a passage from the Talmud, which is actually a comment on the book of Daniel. Some of you may remember, it was 3 or 4 years ago, we did a series on the book of Daniel right here. It was a winter series over the course of, I don't remember how many weeks, we didn't do the whole book. We did primarily the story parts in the first half of the book. But in the second half of the book, you get prophecies from Daniel, which envision a series of empires and ultimately the rise of Mashiach. And the empires are envisioned as beasts, frightening beasts. So the Talmud comments on the vision of a bear in Daniel chapter 7. Take a look at source number 4. The Talmud said, "And a second beast, like a bear, Rav Yosef taught, these are the Persians." I should stop and ask, anyone here from Iran? Okay, that's a relief. You're not necessarily going to like the next line if you are from Iran. These are the Persians who eat and drink like a bear, who are fleshy like a bear, who are hairy like a bear, and who are restless like a bear. So it's explaining why Daniel would have envisioned a bear as the representative of the Persians in his vision of the empires that would rise and fall. Remember that prophets in general tended to have visions that were based in their own perceptions. In other words, only Moshe has direct communication with Hashem. Prophets, their vision and their prophecy is somewhat obscure and often draws on images from their experience. So Daniel's vision of the Persians embodies them as bears. I should note, the Talmud also has nice things to say about Persians. Rabbi Akiva in the Talmud in Brachot talks about how the Persians had good manners, how they ate in a very fine way, how they were very modest in the washer. Like the Rabbi Akiva has nice things to say about the Persians. So don't think that the Talmud is all anti-Persian. But he describes them as a bear, and the keynote within this is the idea that they eat and drink like a bear, and they are restless like a bear. And now we continue with the Maharal's comments, meaning they perpetually seek to swallow up. This is their trait. Where did the Maharal live, by the way? Prague, right? The Altnoi Shul, right? The Maharal of Prague. He's the one who was reported to have created a golem. Right, whether he ever did is a good question, but that's the report. So I don't know how many Persians he met in Prague a few centuries ago. Nonetheless, the description here is that they seek to swallow up. That is their trait. And he brings as an example our chapter. Thus it is written regarding this empire in Esther chapter 10, sentence 1, "And King Ahasuerus placed a tax on the land and the islands of the sea." What does this come to teach, saying that the king placed a tax on the land? Why are you telling me about the tax? Only, it comes to say that this was the strength of Ahasuerus, that he was lacking, and he perpetually sought to fill his desire with wealth. The comment is, what Maharal is saying is, that we bring Ahasuerus' tax at the end of the book to say, this is a man of appetites. This is a man who does not have enough, and he needs to pursue more. Which is really striking, because the way the Talmud describes Ahasuerus, take a look at source number 5, is that he is one of three biblical kings who they credit, as reigning over the entire land. King Ahav, who was a Jewish king, Ahasuerus, and Nebuchadnezzar, the Babylonian king who destroyed the first temple. The Talmud mentions others who may be considered also of Trove reign like that. Yes, we're not talking Western Hemisphere, we're talking Eastern Hemisphere, and at that we're not talking the entire Eastern Hemisphere. I wouldn't get hung up on how far the Babylonian Empire actually stretched or the Persian Empire actually stretched. But the point is that here you describe him as having everything, but he still doesn't have enough. Like the verse in Ecclesiastes, "Ohev kesef, lo yisba kesef." The one who loves money never has enough of it. That's the way Ahasuerus is. And that hunger is consistent with the start of the Megillah as well. Right? In the Megillah, the beginning of it, he is a dominant figure. He is on his throne. He throws a great big party. He throws two parties. A 6-month party and then a 7-day party. With lots of drinking. Which will continue throughout the book of Esther. Party after party. Consumption of alcohol. What he does with his pageant to replace Vashti, having women from the entire kingdom brought to him, and each of them are with him once, and then they have to go off to be in his harem. Ahasuerus is a person of hunger. Ahasuerus is a person of appetites. That is his identity at the beginning, and that's his identity at the end. And to me, you can read this book. I'm not taking away from it being the book of Esther. Certainly that's the dominant identity. However, it's also the book of Ahasuerus, telling the story of Ahasuerus' hunger and where it takes him. Now, here I have to pause, and I brought you a big paragraph in number 6, because I think this is an important point. You familiar with the Goldwater Rule? It stems from U.S. politics, but it's a rule that should be applied everywhere. So, as I brought you in source number 6 from the font of all knowledge, Wikipedia, the Goldwater Rule is the informal name given to Section 7 in the American Psychiatric Association's Principles in Medical Ethics, which states that it is unethical for psychiatrists to give a professional opinion about public figures whom they have not examined in person and from whom they have not obtained consent to discuss their mental health in public statements. It is named after former U.S. Senator and 1964 presidential candidate Barry Goldwater, because in fact there was an article written in which they claimed to analyze his personality, and he ended up suing them and he won, leading to this paragraph which says that's a really bad idea. So I brought you Section 7, you can see it as well. The point is, and the reason why I say it is, because we have a tendency to think ourselves familiar with biblical figures, the good ones and the bad ones. Meaning, I grew up hearing about Abraham and Sarah. I grew up hearing about Moshe. I read about him all the time. Or, in this case, Ahasuerus. I learned about him when I was in kindergarten. They told me all about him. And I've been learning about him ever since. And therefore, I have a sense of familiarity. And I can start thinking that I can say definitively, Ahasuerus was this. But really, when you think about it, how much do we know about any of them? Including the ones we know most about, right? Let's say, I don't know, Moshe. How much do we know? How many years of Moshe's 120 do we know anything about? We know when he was put into the water. We know he's raised by his mother for the first couple of years, because she nurses him. Then he grows up in the palace. We don't know anything about what happens there. At the age of 13, 20, there's some debate. He comes out, gets into a couple of fights, runs away to Midian, saves some girls at the well, marries one of them, and then disappears for at least 60 years, depending again on how old he was when he ran away. I know nothing about what's going on there from the biblical text. There are midrashim that fill in some gaps based on stories in his life. You can sort of figure out some things that happen, but I really don't know anything. Then he takes the Jews out of Egypt. They go off into the wilderness, right? Plagues, split sea, bread from the skies, water from a stone. And then, a year later, the spies go into Israel, bring back a bad report, and then I know nothing about the next 38 years of his life. We pick up again the last year in the wilderness. So, really, I know a little bit here, and a little bit here, and a little bit there, and I think I know him. And I can start talking about him as though I know him. But I don't. And I wouldn't like it if someone knew that little about me, percentage-wise, in my life, and started talking about me. So, the pitch I'm making here, which I think is important beyond this session, is not to make the assumption that we can, in fact, say anything about Ahasuerus personally. This is not a violation of the Goldwater Rule. We are not going to say anything about him personally. But at the same time, when the biblical text gives us evidence about somebody, when it tells us stories about somebody, it's trying to teach us something. And so I think we're free to, as long as we're careful to say, we can't really talk about the person. We can ask, so what exactly is the text trying to tell me by conveying this information? And in this case, by showing us Ahasuerus as a hungry person, what does hunger signify? When you say someone has a hungry personality and you describe them as constantly grasping for more, what does that mean to you? Sorry? Greed for sure. A need for attention and
verification,
validation, perhaps. Yeah.
Never satiated.
Hunger can be an expression of bald appetite, right? It could just be, you know, physiological. You know, he could have a problem. In fact, but often physical appetites conceal an inner psychological need, and that may be the case here, because when you track the events of Megillat Esther. And you may have already done this in the course of the previous classes, you find him hungry for two interrelated things: respect and security. Those are the two elements that you see him hungering for. Respect first. I brought you in source number 7 references to verses within the book itself. The first one, from the very beginning, he throws a 6-month party. Why does he need 6 months for this party? There's a reason. It's not just random. Why does he need 6 months? Right. He has all the leaders of the kingdom there and he wants to impress them. Why not invite them there for a week? Why 6 months? Exactly. He's having everybody come in far and wide. You can't just tell me that everybody from everywhere is just going to show up on the same week. Not to mention, what's that going to do to your empire? If all the dignitaries are in Shushan for that 1 week, chaos throughout the land. So what do? You stagger it. But the point that I see here is his demand that dignitaries from everywhere show up tells us a lot about who he is. This is a man who wants respect. Everybody has to show up to his party. My favorite example of this is, of course, the story with Vashti, right? Which you read about, again, you know, when you're a kid, you hear about this story, and it's really funny that, you know, she wouldn't show up to the party, and therefore, you're a child, so they don't tell you that she's executed. Because the book doesn't say it explicitly, but there's only one way to be an ex-queen in Persia. You didn't retire to Bermuda. But the fact that he's upset, she won't show up, and now he's gonna get so frustrated is amusing when you're a child. But think about what this actually meant. Whom did Ahasuerus consult when Vashti refused to show up at the party? Who did he talk to? Go back, please, to chapter 1, sentences 13 to 15. Oops. It is page 21. The king conferred with the experts who knew the times, for such was the king's procedure to turn to all who knew law and judgment. Those closest to him were Karshana, Shetar, Admata, Tarshish, Meres, Marsanam, Mimuchan, the 7 officers of Persia and Media who had access to the king who sat first in the kingdom. Hello. What was Ahasuerus so bothered by again? What was it that troubled him? That she refused to show up and he was embarrassed. I know what I'll do if I'm embarrassed. I'm going to summon my 7 top political advisors and tell them that my wife refused to show up at the party. Hello. You've just made a problem a lot worse. And then, sentence 19, same page. What do they do? Here's our suggestion, which he follows. If it pleases the king, let there go forth a royal edict from him. Let it be written into the laws of the Persians and the Medes, that it be not revoked, that Vashti never again appear before King Ahasuerus, let the king confer her royal estate. We're going to record that Vashti will never appear again before Ahasuerus. Right? Why? Oh, I'm sorry, we continue? All the wives have to show respect to their husbands, great and small alike. Everybody in the entire kingdom is going to know. You know, when I was a shul rabbi before coming to Canada, I was a shul rabbi in a relatively small community. We had 230 families in the shul. And there was a particular communal issue going on. And it involved, you know, a bunch of families from the shul. And there was a little bit of a push, like, you know, I should make a statement, I should speak about it. And I was thinking about it. I talked to somebody from the shul who was aware of what was going on. And he said to me very wise advice, which I, thank God, have never forgotten because it's good advice. He said, what percentage of the shul do you think knows about this issue right now? I said to him, I don't know, 10, 15%. He said, if you speak about it from the pulpit, that's going to be 100%. Do you really want to do that? Wise advice. That's what Ahasuerus just violated. Ahasuerus took what had embarrassed him when it took place at the party and spread it over the entire land. What in the world are you thinking? Why? It's so bizarre. That it's bizarre first that he takes it as a matter for his political advisors. So much so that the Talmud, take a look at source number 8, offers a suggestion. Yon, I'm not going to read it out. It's interesting in its own right, but I'm just going to convey the key point from it, which is that Vashti was not simply Ahasuerus's queen. She was the power in the family. That she was a holdover from the Babylonians, whom the Persians had defeated. And therefore she was the one with royal standing, and Ahasuerus was the stable boy who married the princess, and therefore became king. That's a way to explain why Vashti's refusal would necessitate a conference with political advisors. Because it's not a domestic issue. It's actually a political issue. They're trying to solve this problem of why in the world he makes this a political fight, but the simple read is, this is a man who is wildly insecure. And then you jump to chapter 2, right? And Ahasuerus chooses a queen. Who does he choose? We know. Esther, right? He chooses Esther. That's a very interesting decision. Who does he think Esther is? He has no idea. He has no idea whatsoever what background she has. If you think back to the kings of medieval Europe, not just medieval Europe, but the kings of Europe in general over the centuries, what sorts of marriages did they engage in? Political marriages. As a matter of fact, you find that not just in Europe of the last millennium, but you find it in biblical times. Jewish kings did it, engaged in political marriages. Why does Ahasuerus, who is taking a new queen, choose not someone from some powerful empire, but instead someone who very carefully hides her roots?
Doesn't want competition.
Exactly. This is a man who is afraid. He doesn't want another Vashti. He doesn't want somebody else who's going to cause him problems. The Talmud highlights this in source number 9, when it suggests that when the Megillah says that Esther bore favor in the eyes of all who saw her, Rabbi Elazar said, this teaches she appeared to each one as though she was from his nation. Everyone assumes she's on my side. Oh, is this man insecure? And Haman plays on it. Right? With his sales pitch for getting rid of the Jews. They don't listen to you, Ahasuerus. They don't follow your rules. And of course, the Talmud picks up on that in source number 10. And their law is different from that of any other nation. They do not eat our food. They don't marry among us. They don't marry theirs to us. They don't practice the king's laws. They spend the entire year saying, today is Shabbat, today is Pesach. Sorry, that's what they say. And it is not worthwhile for the king to let them be. They eat and drink and mock the throne. Even if a fly would fall into the cup of one of them, he would throw out the fly and drink it. But if my master, the king, would touch the cup of one of them, he would throw it on the ground. He would not drink it. He won't drink the wine that you touched, O king. Playing on the insecurity. Also plays up on some of the wording that Haman uses, but I'm not going to go into the specifics right now. Not only that, the Maharal of Prague makes an additional interesting observation. Haman says to Ahasuerus, I want to have the Jews destroyed. I think it's in your best interest to destroy them. And the price is going to be 10,000 silver coins. Right? That's the price for their destruction, and I am willing to pay it. Right? I'm on page 29. It's in chapter 3, sentence 9. If it pleases the king, let it be recorded to be destroyed. I will pay 10,000 silver talents into the hands of those who perform the duties for deposit in the king's treasuries. I'm going to bankroll it, Haman says. What does Ahasuerus say back? What does he say to him? Close. He doesn't quite say you can keep your money. That's the way I would have read it. You can keep your money. The Maharal of Prague is more careful in his read than we are. The wording in the Hebrew is hakesef natun lach. As they translate here in sentence 11, the silver is given to you. What does that mean? Says the Maharal of Prague in source number 11. Because Ahasuerus perpetually sought to swallow up, he said to Haman, the money is given to you. Not, I don't want your money. I accept it from you, and I give it back to you. He didn't hold on to the money. It would have been disgraceful for him to accept money and then give the nation over for execution for the sake of the money. That would have looked like he's being bribed. Oh no. That I'm not going to do. What does he do? For love of money, he receives it, and then he gives the money back. He wants to be in a superior power position. I have the money, and out of my largesse, I'm now going to give it to you. This is the way it plays throughout the book. Yeah, you can see it at the end when Ahasuerus talks about how when Ahasuerus doesn't repeal the decree or do anything on behalf of saving the Jews, right? The Jews are still in danger after Haman is gone. Because all Ahasuerus cared about was getting rid of this upstart Haman, who is a problem for Ahasuerus. And after that, whatever happens to the Jews happens. That's not his concern. Ahasuerus is concerned about his respect. He's also concerned about security. That's his other major need. Now, you know the line. You're not necessarily paranoid if people are out to get you. The truth is, they are out to get Ahasuerus, right? In chapter 2, Bigtan and Teresh do in fact plot against the king. But look at chapter 3, sentence 1. We are told, after these things being the plot of Bigtan and Teresh, Ahasuerus promoted Haman, the son of Hamedata the Agagite. Made him above everybody else. Made him the viceroy. Everybody's got to listen to Haman. Who was Haman until he was elevated? Sorry? So there is a midrash, which I brought you in, source number 13, that suggests he was Memuchan, one of those seven advisors found in the first chapter. However, other midrashim say that Memuchan is Daniel. In which case, Haman is a nobody. And the Talmud plays up the fact, or the idea, I should say, that he's a nobody. Take a look at source number 15. Haman was a barber of a place called Kfar Kartzum for 22 years. The other midrash, by the way, I brought you a number 14 that says that Daniel is the one who was Memuchan. My point is, you took a barber, perhaps, or just a general nobody, and you made him second in command in the entire kingdom? What are you thinking? Why would you do that? What's the answer? What happens when you take a nobody and you put him in a position like that? He is grateful and he is dependent. Right? Everything he has comes through you. Ahasuerus is a man living with a hunger for security, and so he says, I'm going to take a nobody and put him in this position. This is the way everything will go through the bottleneck and ultimately back to me. Something we find in other ways, actually, in the book of Daniel, but not for right now. It fits in with him not allowing anybody into his throne room uninvited. It fits into his generous offer to Queen Esther, whom he loves so much. Right, Esther, anything, up to half the kingdom. I just want to make sure I keep voting rights. Right? He's a romantic, this one. And Esther takes advantage of it, right? She invites Haman to the party twice. making Ahasuerus jealous of Haman, and ultimately starting him wondering. Which is why when we get to chapter 6, Ahasuerus displays his insecurity, right? He can't sleep. Was Mordecai ever rewarded? Let them bring the chronicles and read. Maybe something is wrong. There's a plot against me and I'm not going to know about it. There's a fear that he feels. He's scared. I brought it in source number 16. Ahasuerus wonders. He said, what is this that Esther invited Haman? Perhaps they're taking counsel against that man, meaning me, to kill him. And then he said, well, someone must be on my side. Someone will tell me. Maybe somebody benefited me and I didn't pay him back. And that's why no one is warning me about this plot. And so he has the chronicles read to him, and he finds out Mordecai wasn't rewarded, and he says, hey, who's outside? Why does he ask who's outside? Why does Ahasuerus ask who's outside? What kind of a reaction is that when someone says, who's outside? Fear. Right? He's not looking for an advisor in the middle of the night. Right? In the middle of the night, they read him the story and he thinks, oh no, I need advice. I better ask who's lurking outside my throne room at, you know, midnight. That's not what's going on. He's afraid someone has come to kill me. So he asks, who's outside in the middle of the night? And of course, it's Haman outside in the middle of the night. Haman, that's really interesting. He's the same one who was invited to the party with Esther. Maybe it's time to offer a test and see if he is loyal. I know. Tell me something. What would you suggest should be done to somebody the king wishes to honor? And Haman says to himself, who is the king going to want to honor other than me? Tell me something. Is Haman right? When Haman thinks to himself, who would the king want to honor if not me? Is Haman right? He is right. Of course he's right. You know why? Because Ahasuerus is afraid of everybody else. The only one he wants to honor is the nobody he elevated. Haman is politically sharp. He just doesn't realize that Mordecai has an in with the king because Mordecai helped the king. But what Haman says makes a whole lot of sense. Except that he overplays his hand. He says, I think you should probably hand over the royal garb and the horse and the crown, the whole bit, right? And parade around the city saying, this is the one the king wants to honor. And Ahasuerus says, okay, I sized him up. I know who this guy is. And then, of course, the end of the story for Haman has Ahasuerus find out that Haman is attacking Esther's people. And then Haman comes back in from his garden. Why he's in the garden is a discussion for another time. But he comes back in from the garden and he finds Haman falling on the bed on which Esther was seated. It's so perfect that the Talmud in source number 17 suggests that God actually appointed a malach, an angel, to push Haman onto the bed in order to play on that fear. Ahasuerus is a man living in hunger for respect and hunger for security. And so he schemes. He comes up with plots and plans. And there's a passage in the Talmud that plays into this perfectly. And I learned this passage as a little kid and didn't understand what it was trying to say because, you know, you're a kid when you hear this story. Tell me something. Ahasuerus, wise or foolish? Smart king or foolish king? Sorry? Foolish. Yeah, we've got one vote for foolish. You're not going to guess wrong. Yeah. Could be one, could be the other. As a kid, maybe because they don't want you to learn about like villains and bad people, so they tell you he's a fool. But the truth of the matter is, the Talmud is of two minds regarding Ahasuerus. It has a similar conversation regarding an Assyrian king named Sancheriv. But take a look at source number 18. Brilliant. It's commenting on Ahasuerus' series of parties, where he first has a 6-month party for all the dignitaries, and then a 7-day party for the locals. Look at this. At the conclusion of these days, source number 18, Rav and Shmuel debated. One said he was a wise king. The other said he was a foolish king. The one who said he was a wise king said he did well. The strategy of the two parties was smart. Drawing near the distant first. First, he takes care of the distant people, all those dignitaries. For he can always appease the residents of his city. Later on, you take care of your base. They'll wait a little bit. Take care of everybody else, and then your base. So what he did was sharp. The one who said he was foolish said no. He should have drawn the residents of his city near first. For if the others would rebel, these would stand with him. No, take care of your base first. You should have had a party for the locals. And then after that, have a party for the foreign dignitaries. But play to your base first. He's a fool. That's the Talmudic discussion. But the underlying message here in this conversation is that Ahasuerus has a goal he's trying to achieve with these parties. And the only question is he good at it or not? What is Ahasuerus' motivation with the parties? Safety. It's all about safety. So what he's trying to do is get the dignitaries on his side, and he's trying to get the locals on his side. And either he did it right, thinking, I could take care of the dignitaries and then the locals I'll mop up later. Or he was foolish. He should have really taken care of the locals first. But either way, it's all a plan to try to get him, the empire, under control. That's Ahasuerus. It's all power. It's power, but it's fear-driven, specifically. And when Ahasuerus is threatened, he lashes out. You can find this in any number of psychological works. I happen to pick one that has a Jewish author, Dr. Shlomo Reimer, The Emotional Foundations of the Human Personality, in source number 19. The absence of emotional security always tends to spawn hate. The combination of emotional insecurity and hate invariably gives rise to a personality trait in which aggression is practiced for the express purpose of bolstering security. He becomes aggressive in order to make himself secure, and so he lashes out at those he considers a threat. Vashti, the Jews, and eventually Haman. And to me, that's the message of the book of Ahasuerus. Ahasuerus provides a lesson for every generation about how we respond to fear and tension. We see this man start in one situation, enter into conflict and problems, which in most stories are meant to transform your protagonist in a positive way. But Ahasuerus responds to the conflict and the problems by lashing out, and he concludes the story the same way he was at the beginning. He's the same person throughout the Megillah. Doesn't learn, doesn't change. And maybe that's what the Megillah is telling us with the tax and the rest of this chapter, chapter 10. At the end of the Megillah, he's the same person he was all along. He's a person who is seeking validation and who takes from everyone in pursuit of satisfying his need for respect and for security within himself. That's what we're getting here. But why is this in Tanakh? It isn't good enough to say, so Mordechai and Esther with this book are taking a slap at Ahasuerus by ending the book in this way. It's not really about Ahasuerus, it's really about us. The stories that we find in Chumash and the stories that we find in Tanakh have lessons to teach about what Hashem values and rejects, what Hashem rewards and punishes, and about human behavior. Whether you're talking about Cain and Hevel, and the generation of the flood, or the city of Sodom, or whether you're talking about the King Nebuchadnezzar and King Belshazzar and King Cyrus, there are always lessons for us to learn. And Ahasuerus's arc is contrasted here with our own. Because we started the book also with a lack of respect. And we started the book as well with a lack of security. And we also underwent conflict and problems as Haman wanted to destroy us. But in the conclusion of the book, we've become a new nation. We read in chapter 8, sentence 17, Rabbim me'amei haaretz mityahadim, that the people of that land actually were choosing to become Jewish. The nations were afraid of us. Mordechai at the end is Mishne Lamelech. He is the viceroy. We have been transformed. What's the difference? Why did we go one way while Ahasuerus went the other way? Because of what we did in the middle. Right? Ahasuerus, in the middle, responds to his fears and appetites by grasping for control and taking for himself. Mordechai and Esther responded by relinquishing control, turning to God for support, and acting selflessly. Esther allowed herself to be taken to the king. Mordechai told Esther about the plot of Bigtan and Teresh, and she told Ahasuerus. The nation fasted for 3 days, an act of prayer to God. Esther endangered herself going to the king. And it's highlighted at the end when we're told about Mordechai that he seeks the welfare of his nation as well as the next generation. Seeking not to take, but to give. The king who tries to feed his needs by taking is just running in place. He's stuck. Mordechai, Esther, the nation, who seek not to take, but instead to give, they end up growing and ultimately prospering in the course of the book. So I am very grateful for you asking me to give this class, because I had not thought about it in this way until I had to sit down and come up with something to say about three verses. So I very much appreciate it. And God willing, when we follow the path of Mordechai and of Esther, we will merit that we should have light, that we should have joy and celebration and honor. Thank you very much.
Thank you.